Hello and welcome to Healthy Mind, Healthy Life with your host Avik. This podcast is all about exploring the latest research, sharing personal stories and providing personal tips for improving our mental health and well-being. Each episode will be joined by experts in the field of mental health as well as individuals who have experienced the transformative power of a healthy mind firsthand. Together, we will dive into a range of topics from managing stress and anxiety to building resilience and cultivating happiness. So, join us on this journey to discover new ways to take care of our minds, bodies, and souls. And let's work together to create a healthier, happier world one episode at a time. So, let's get started. Hello and welcome to Healthy Mind, Healthy Life. I'm your host, Avik, and today we are joined by Daniel. So welcome to the show, Daniel.
Thank you so much, Avik.
Great. So Daniel, like before we start our conversation today, I would love to mention this to all of our listeners that Daniel is a leader in regenerative health and personalized medicine. So his journey began with the personal health challenges, sparkling his exploration of molecular biology and stem cell research. So with a degree in stem cell biology and experience in molecular profiling, Daniel founded Timeline Sciences to align individuals with their unique genetic makeup and goals. So why to wait? Let's join us as we delve into his story and the transformative potential of personalized medicine. So welcome to the show again, Daniel.
Thank you. I'm excited to talk here about things that I feel are very important for today's day, right?
Yes.
In a time where science is never been more complicated and has never been more distant from the average person.
Exactly. So to start with, Daniel, like if you can share your journey from experiencing the health challenges to delving into the field of regenerative medicine and the personalized health, if you can share a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I started off with a lot of problems as a kid. I had asthma, quite severe asthma. I'd be rushed to the hospital on a weekly basis. And later in life, I had terrible gastrointestinal problems. So, allergies to, things you wouldn't even, you can consider you'd be allergic to, but it'd be off and on too. So quite sporadic. And, that really caused me to go towards being a doctor. That was the goal. But we didn't get there. We asked too many questions in order to be a doctor, right? I don't think I'd get through the patients I need to get through in a day. I'd probably be stuck on one or two as I take a deep dive in on what's happening with them. And so I went the science route. And it is, stem cell biology is really cell biology. The stem part is added, so it sounds a little more fancy. But to me, it's always been a question as to what happens if you keep zooming in and microscopically in on what we are. And what happens is you see that we're cellular beings. And there's somewhere around 50 to 70 trillion cells cooperating to make you up. And to me, that's really a fascinating venture to try and understand how is it one even possible? What holds it all together? And how is it when they all work simultaneously beautifully in harmony, we get to experience, the higher level orders of cognition. And so that was really the driving force to move and try to understand, really the principles of life.
Yeah.
And that brought me to full circle, eventually helping people with what I learned. I didn't like sitting in a laboratory and being isolated and, writing academic papers. Rather, I really enjoyed taking what I learned and bringing it right to people's lives. And there's so many small things that we can change within our daily habits that can have long lasting effects on the cellular health. And in turn, that is going to then play well into our physical, spiritual, emotional, mental well-being.
Lovely. That's really great. So, so how does your background in the stem cell biology inform your approach to understanding and addressing the health issues?
That's a great question. So one great thing about taking the opportunity to study what a stem cell is that within the human body in the adult, each organ has or doesn't have a reserve stem cell pool. So what do I mean by that? In the intestine, you have a reserve stem cell, an intestinal stem cell, and it functions in a small little niche meaning that it's not on its own functioning, but it needs to function in with a little bit of a microenvironment in order for it to be able to continuously divide. And in the intestine, 3 to 5 days, you have a full new lining. So very active regenerative organ. The brain, not very regenerative. If you injure the brain, only the hippocampal cells are we're really confident that it'll have turnover so you can make new ones. So in the idea of the area in the brain where it makes memories is also able to make new neurons. But if you damage cortical matter, so the top part of your brain, it doesn't regenerate. And there is a scarring process, and that scarring process is regeneration as well. And so that's a slight little differentiation there, is that every organ can undergo this process called a scar.
Okay.
Right. And that scar is absolutely pivotal in order for healing to occur. And so there's quite a lot of interest, for example, in the brain, is that if you can manipulate the scar in a little way, could there be some room for a little bit of more regeneration of the cortical matter? And what really determines whether an organ can regenerate is there a cell present there that can divide into what you would like as the main, call it organ? And the fancy word is parenchyma. So, you know, in the liver cell is the parenchymal cell. It's the one that's doing the big function for the organ. And everything else there is supporting it, and it's called the stroma. And so what I spent a lot of time studying is the stroma, because no matter where you get damaged in the body, that stroma is going to do a regenerative process that starts off with inflammation, is going to recruit in cells, then it's going to go under a process of proliferation, spread out, and then it's going to have some chemical signaling before you can have resolution. And if everything's going great and according to plan, that scar is going to dissolve. If there's problems along the way, that scar stays as a means of scaffolding to hold things together. So that stroma, that connective tissue, and connective tissue is one of the dirtiest words in science. You know, when you don't know really what's going on, you just throw in and say it's in the connective tissue. But that connective tissue is critical to be able to heal any organ. And so this is where I spend a lot of time studying, so that I can help facilitate when someone is in a need to have a very specific regeneration, or just systemically saying, hey, how can I do things in order to get a little better in terms of, you know, health and vitality. And so there's a lot of secrets that are in that connective tissue. It's quite the exploding field. Mm-hmm. There's publications that are absolutely over 700 to 800 clinical trials every single year on mesenchymal stem cells, but very little bit of effect on seeing anything in terms of, you know, it doing what people wish it would do, which is that kind of restorative regenerative process. And so there's, you know, you can look to the future and have some hopes that the, you know, the stem cell technology will, you know, will work out, or you can take that knowledge and work with what cells you have. How do you support your stem cell niches? How do you support your cellular health? How do you take care of them? And, you know, what can you do on a day-to-day basis in order to be able to make that, you know, the stromal component as best as you can?
Exactly. Exactly true. Great. Also, like, if you can explain the concept of science literacy and its significance in the today's society.
Absolutely. Today, you know, what I find for a lot of people that come to me, and for example, have engineers come, they have a very good understanding of their field. They're very, very smart people, but they are starting to believe in science. And so, you know, they see that there are other professionals in the field. They're talking about, you know, there are things that are interested in terms of health and how they can take care of themselves. Uh-huh. And they're not able to discern what is marketing and story versus what is science. Mm. And so that is a big part today, where now if the person can't recognize who the, you know, the real expert is, or who the real smart person is in the room, they're sort of in a whims of, you know, who's a little more aggressive, who's a better salesman. And, you know, lucky for me, when I get this, you know, go with one-on-one with an individual, I can ask questions to check their understanding, and in which helps then to find where they might have a problem or confusion, in which then we can build from that and give them a foundation so that they can do a better job at discerning what's the science from what's the story. And so a very easy example here, if we take it back to, you know, the cells and the, you know, body and the blood, there was work done 100 years ago.
Okay.
That was on lactic acid. People drew blood. They found out the concentration value, and they did it in different individuals and different challenges.
Yeah.
But they said at that point in time, within their model that they were developing, that, well, it seems like this is part of the fatigue, and the lactic acid is causing the, you know, the soreness and the fatigue. So that was wrong. That was wrong. But today, even though that's wrong, I can still use what they left as the fundamental science within that. So what was the science? Well, it's the concentration values. It's the age of the individuals that they drew them from. It's the location that they drew them. It's the technology they used in order to be able to get to those values. And so that's useful. I can use that information now to compare to our demographics, our groups, our cohorts, or individuals that are practicing and trying to get into, molecular testing for themselves. So that's the difference between science and the story. The science there stands the test of time for you to be able to build on it. And if it's quality science, it'll be useful, even if it's very small and, what seems like not really big in terms of grand scheme of things. It's extremely useful to have someone's blood value 100 years ago. Now you can compare, today, is there anything specific in that pathway? Are we shifted very much? So is the average man or average woman very, having that concentration drastically different, therefore causing us to address, maybe there's a very quick shift in our environment. Mm-hmm. It isn't, but just on a more of a story scale. Mm-hmm. And so this is the, I think, the part that's very important today. And, I can't speak for India, how it is, but today here, mm-hmm. calories are the most confusing topic for people.
Yeah.
And calories seem to be on the back of food packaging, yet there's very little tie into the actual science. And so this is another great example of how, if you don't have the science literacy, meaning like, well, I don't even know what questions to ask to get to, the point of which I want to have this information, it ends up being a turn of the wheel where people are saying the exact same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And, they'll propagate ideas out there. And I do think that's a little bit of on purpose. I do think there's very smart people that make it confusing so that there is a level of a business that can say, hey, we know things, come to us, and try to keep a little bit of distance from the average individual. Yeah. Right. So, let me turn it back to you. What is a calorie? Is it a form of energy or is it a unit of measure?
I would say for me, it's kind of a unit of measure.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. But you'd be surprised how many individuals would think it's a form of energy because it's on the back of, all food labels.
Yeah.
Right. It's, hey, you got to have calories to have energy. Yeah. So there's this sort of very critical necessity to have a certain level of understanding of okay, well, that sentence is wrong, but I understand the meaning. And we have to be careful when we keep inferring about what people's intent is with it, rather than holding them to a higher standard of articulating the science at hand,
Yeah, exactly. That's true. So, what are some of the common misconceptions like people have about personalized medicine and regenerative health? What do you say?
The one big one that I've come across is this idea that it's just it's just more medicine. So they're still waiting for problems to come before they think that, oh, well, I'll just go get the stem cell treatment and I'll have, it'll do it. But that's still just medicine. Yeah. The idea of preventative medicine or preventative approaches, preventative healthcare, is for you while you're healthy, while you're doing okay, to do your best to be able to examine where's your life trending.
Yeah.
Which way are you going to go towards? That's the whole idea of my company, Timeline Sciences, is that I help you track out where you might have some pitfalls, whether it's going to be a cardiovascular, a metabolic, or a respiratory complication, and act before it becomes a real problem. Because just like we were talking about stem cells earlier, if you destroy the reserve pool of stem cells, good luck. There's no regenerating. But so long as you're able to maintain a level of your body, the capacity for the body to regenerate is immense. It is absolutely wonderful that when you leave this, the most complicated piece of biotechnology on the planet alone, it heals on its own. And so that's a big part, I think, that comes into play today is understanding how, for example, fasting, how herbs, small supplements can act on the body in such a way in which it's going to help you have that preventative, protective approach for the body. And as well as very simple things, small little muscle activation, contracting your muscles on particular times throughout the day will secrete into your blood, for example, brain-derived neurotrophic factors. So you contract your muscles, you get BDNF in the blood. That BDNF then acts on the brain to protect the brain from inflammatory processes that might be going on in the body. And so then what's that long-term mean? Well, if you had consistent small level of activities throughout your life, that means your likelihood of getting Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, neurodegenerative complications is drastically lower, right? And you can see that within blood work too. And you know, the preventive medicine is quite an exciting field because, you know, no one wants to live, not very many people want to live so isolated and devoid of all the pleasures of what's present today. But knowing how to be able to set yourself up so that when you want to indulge, it's not going to be deleterious to you, that you can go ahead and enjoy life and be in social context without a worry. You can spend a weekend at a wedding and, you know, really let loose and enjoy that time. But that doesn't mean that a week after you're sick or you're unable to move or, you know, you've done damage to your organs. Yeah. That's sort of the idea. And so, you know, one of the best supplements that I've researched, come across, I've used now for, you know, lots of therapeutics is turmeric, right? AKA haldi. I think it's in Hindu, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It's haldi. And so, so very powerful compound, and there's lots of compounds within it, and it can be used both medicinally in a higher concentration form, or just within cooking to provide a whole boatload of benefits, from minerals to molecules that can help clean out the cell, help with the autophagy and the self the recycling of the cell. And so small, you know, this is why I also think some of the especially within with Vancouver, where I'm from, we have a large population of East Indian within Surrey, and they have some of the worst diets, in terms of what they're consuming, but yet some of the least amount of cardiovascular disease in correlation with the food that they're eating. So obviously they have some protective effects. And now this is when I get into the biases and quite the intrigue of the incredible amount of spices that come from India.
Yeah,
and and how they have these profound effects in the body. And so how such a small spice can have such a massive effect, to me, that's also my what I'm searching for. So someone doesn't have to have a massive cabinet of supplements that they got to take every single day. Can we just simplify it to a few things? So
exactly. And so this so haldi or the turmeric, I'm not sure about out of India, but in India it's a sign of for good health thing. It's a sign for spirituality also we use it in India. But in terms of science, if I say yes, in India we use turmeric in all of our food, and also like for the for any, we also believe that it kills the infections. It it's very healthy for our inner body to give that strength to kill those infections. So there are a lot of other things as well. So yeah, thanks for bringing this. It's a really, really it's a really very ingredient, I would say. It's we use in most of our food we cook. So yeah,
well, I do have the molecular backing for this, where individuals have come with, in a big part, two of the issues. One is clotting issues, and then two would be inflammatory issues, and in both circumstances it's drastically changed those people's molecular profile, from having, you know, clearly there's an effect on the liver, so meaning that it directly interacts with the liver, and it helps calm down or pull out issues of inflammation, right? And again, inflammation isn't in itself a bad thing. That's part of the regenerative response. But to pull what the problem is out is sometimes very hard to know what to do. And it just and it seems turmeric has the capacity to do that in almost a very general sense, so that it can target quite a few things that can get lodged in the body.
Wow, that's really lovely. Yeah. So, from your perspective, like, how can the individuals maintain that healthy blood chemistry to support a healthy mind and a healthy life?
Yeah, I mean, first is going to come sleep. That let's say in order of importance, because if one night of bad sleep can have a massive ramification for the body, and so. It's also that if you it's very, very intuitive. If you damage your recovery system, then it's only a matter of time before you burn out completely. And so sleep is very regenerative and recovers the function of everything within our in a mammalian being.
Yeah.
The second that comes into that is taking time away from food. So fasting is kind of known today. And taking that to a level of understanding that every time we put something in, we're going to have to go through a process of a very expensive process of assimilating that into us. And it is, especially in North America, done on such a fast dime. You know, if people are walking and drinking their coffees, they'll consume, you know, very quickly different foods. And so it's not even the fact of what you're eating, but how often are you eating and, you know, in what quantity. And so in every single model organism, when the organism is fasted, giving it, for example, 16 hours of no food and then, you know, 8 hours of access to food, every single animal benefits in terms of lifespan. And on a molecular level, it showcases the benefits on the DNA level, on the proteomic or the, you know, mitochondria, as people I think are aware what that is, and then on the cellular signaling level. So fasting is absolutely key. And then obviously, you know, there is a level of quality of food, more so importance than, you know, let's just go going into what the calories, really the utility of calories is this idea of macronutrients, of protein, fat, and carbohydrates. And the reason those three are relevant is because it's from those three that we can strip the atoms and use for energy metabolism. Right. And in today's day, and I think in India too, might be true, that it's easy to get the calories, but it's very hard to get the nutrition.
Exactly.
And the nutrition is, you know, for example, the things in which when you consume the fat, that the body doesn't want to use it and strip it of its atoms for just energy. It wants to use it as building blocks. It wants to use it as cell membranes. It wants to use it as, you know, pieces of, that's what a cell is. It's just a lot of membranes from the outside and then all the way down. And so in order, giving your body those nutrients, for example, like choline. Choline is not a macronutrient, but it's pivotal for us to have that within the diet. And so it's absolutely key to have that quality of food in a very simple way, in which I have a, you know, I often use a small little cell, a plant cell that's alive. And when you look at the plant cell that's alive underneath the microscope, you can see a stream, almost like a whirlpool within it. And what's happening is in there is there is a cytoplasmic streaming event that's occurring. There's water that's the cell itself is shifting around. You can see that it's alive. It's moving contents through itself. And now when you eat something with that regard, you've captured as much as you can in terms of nutrition. Obviously, you have to eat human specific. You can't go eat, you know, grass or whatnot. You know, we don't have the enzymes for that. It still has to be within the realm of what we can digest. But the fact that it's alive holds a lot of these small molecules that we know from metabolomics are there. We don't fully know what every single one does yet. You know, the nutrition science is competent in that regard. But we know that when someone is very ill, if they consume mostly food that's alive, then their ability to regenerate skyrockets, right? And so pasta, you know, rice to a lot of regards, that's food that has calories, but not much life in it. And that's one thing to consider when we're thinking about nutrition. So if we're constantly hungry, maybe it's because that we're not hungry for calories. Maybe we're missing something critical or pivotal within it, or we've wrecked our hormonal system that signals whether we're hungry or not. And one very simple a mineral that is often deficient here in North America, I'm not sure about the Indian population, is iodine. And so if you don't have enough iodine, you can get very, very, you can get a signal of false hunger consistently. So that there is always I eat the food, but unless I've had something that completely spikes my insulin super high for me to feel satiated, I won't. And so the iodine is a key supplement in order to have that, hey, I feel satiated with the food that I've put in my stomach. And so I think those, you know, the sleep, the fasting, the quality of food, you know, the one that's very difficult and, you know, you can say it and you can understand it intellectually, but it's more about living it and putting it into practice. It's about mood and temperament. And the idea to remember is that those people that laugh a lot end up living quite a bit longer than those that don't. And so this idea of the temperament is, you know, it's this gratitude or this connection, this, you know, spark for life, the desire to make, you know, the scenarios that you're around with in individuals in their company almost fun and enjoyable and bring out some kind of humor in the scenarios. And so that temperament has quite an effect on how the body coordinates in terms of, you know, hormonal system that, you know, feeds back in very positive ways for the hormones, for, you know, really the part that is the physiology, you know, the heart, the lungs, the brain. So the temperament is key. And you can't tell someone, hey, you need to be happy or make more jokes. It has to come somewhere from within to recognize, like, hey, you know, like, I am in control of my mood. What is this putting me in these states? And to know that when we're not in the best of state, when we're in a depressed state, that we need to rest. We need to find a way to be able to, you know, shut the body down, to be able to get the recovery mechanisms activated, to put us back in a state of like, yeah, okay, wait a minute, what did I come here to do? And the last one I'll mention is, and it's subtle but extremely relevant, is that the way that we breathe is absolutely critical to the overall health of every single part of our body. So we need oxygen in virtually all cells. Only a few cells don't need oxygen. Like red blood cells won't use it because obviously they're carrying it. The need for the cell to have oxygen can be quite dysfunctional. And so when we take time to practice, or we slow our breath down, or we do breathing retention, or very simple, a box breathing.
Yeah.
Breathe in for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, exhale for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds. Hmm. Now that's great. Now take that up to 8 seconds, take that up to 10 seconds, take it up to 12 seconds. That starts becoming an exercise in itself. But what that helps drastically is it helps, one, equal the pressures within our different chambers, the pressure that's in the chest, in the abdomen, and the stomach, and even within the cranium. So if someone's having headaches, this type of breathing exercise helps shift so that the pressures equalize between the chambers. And not only that, but we can kind of think of the way the cell uses oxygen like a fisherman catching fish. When we haven't been in the best state, active, respecting the biology that we, you know, that we're given, you can think of it, a fisherman having only one fishing rod in the ocean, and he's not going to get a lot of oxygen in there. And now when we do, for example, like a breathing retention exercise or that box breathing, all of a sudden there's a little bit of scarcity for the oxygen. And all of a sudden, like, okay, quick, we need to get a boatload more fishermen, everyone out with their fishing rods. And the cell does the same thing where it changes the protein machinery that's present on its membranes.
Yeah.
And it starts dealing with the gas exchange within the cell very adequately. And one key part about the way that our body recognizes gases is that it actually recognizes carbon dioxide. The brainstem finds carbon dioxide it has a sensor for carbon dioxide, and then is able to then release the protein in there to be able to change the way that we can make sure to facilitate it stay alive. And there's a key part in that carbon dioxide sensor where, one, it will release buffers into the blood, meaning it'll change the alkalinity or acidity within the blood, making it ever so slightly alkaline. That ever so slightly alkaline will actually increase the rate of exchange for the red blood cells within the capillaries to exchange gas. And so when this happens, it really makes the cell have a cleaning process that isn't autophagy, but rather what it's doing is it's helping make sure that there isn't a leakiness happening within the cells that are going to cause just oxidative damage within their local environment. And so breathing is something in which happens to us, but when we take control of it, it is the biggest hack for your health and well-being. And so, you know, are you on blood pressure medication? Well, you know, how come you're too lazy to do a simple breathing exercise? And so this is some of the, you know, practices I think people don't know exist. They don't know that the science is pretty much solved. It's all there. I try to simplify as best I can here in that quick spiel, but you know, this is also a little bit of a paradigm shift for people to understand this preventative medicine or preventative approaches, preventative lifestyles, is knowing some of these breathing exercises, knowing when to do them, knowing what to look for, how to progress through them, is a means in which you're going to be able to keep your system healthy and away from these prescription drugs in which so many of the older population have fallen prey to. But where I see now a lot of, you know, men and women within their 40s and 50s, they're waking up. You know, they're recognizing that that isn't the way to, you know, that isn't the future that they want for themselves. That isn't the only way that you can go about having health. And so hopefully those few examples are there to be like, what can you do in order to be able to maintain that, the stem cell niches in your body?
Exactly. Exactly. Very, very true. So before we wrap up, like, what advice would you give to someone who is looking to improve their understanding of science and its implications for their health and the well-being?
Yeah, very, very difficult to be able to tell someone exactly, hey, here's how you're going to go about approaching science. But if I can give the very simplest one, it's science is observe, measure, predict. So, you know, if the observation isn't done well, there's no moving forward. So if we observe something, we integrate it, we have to come in some type of knowledge afterwards. We make a characterization. You take the world as it is, and you put it into a world of symbols. And that world of symbols should be accessible to everyone. If there's confusion at that level, there's just no going forward, right? And this is where definitions have to be extremely clear and constantly refined, or at least put forward. You know, this is again why the calories is such a misleading topic, is people define calories differently. How can you have a word that has multiple definitions within the same context? Not possible. And the next part is the part that you do need some experience, but you can know how to ask the right question. And it's everything to do with measurements. And that's the part where science were very tedious. No one really wants to know, or no one really wants to do, but everyone wants to know. Sure. Better say it that way.
Yeah.
It is, your measurement is only as good as your control. And so the better you get at understanding the field that you're interested in is knowing that if someone puts an information forward, what control do they have in order to give you confidence that that measurement has any meaning?
Sure.
And you have to be very careful with taking something that's, for example, in a disease state and applying it to someone that's healthy. Because really think of three different individuals. Think of regular individual, super resilient, you know, like Superman style, advanced human being, like, an athlete or someone that's pushed their body in very high challenges, heat stress, cold stress, someone that's become resilient, or disease state. The blood will have a different response depending who you are. And so in those scenarios, it's very important to have controls in order to know what the measurement means. And the last part is the part that, you know, often people say hypothesis within science, but really what they're referring to, from at least from my understanding, is that they're talking about a model. And at the end of science, you have to make a guess. You did work, maybe you looked at mushrooms and now you make some measurements around them. Some had poison aspects, someone didn't. Now you have to make some kind of model at the end, some kind of guess. And it's okay if the guess isn't perfect, but it's encompassing some part of what you've done in terms of observing and measuring. And that guess is there in order to give people some access or some way to be able to use your information. And in which so doing, the better the way to set up the experiment, you know, is through a question, not through a hypothesis. Yeah. So if we take a look in a very simple sense, you know, I want to know how A interacts with B. That's my hypothesis. And I could spend years at looking how A interacts with B, and it could be completely artifact, the one I forced in the laboratory. Versus if I start off with a question, a very simple, simple way, what does A interact with? I'll have to set up a way and be able to catch A through Z. And I'll be like, oh, look, A through K has a really crazy interaction. I should study that one. And then I can go forward on it. And so this is one thing to recognize within science, is who's chasing what we say, like the rabbit through the rabbit hole, meaning there's just no, you're never going to get anything anywhere. It doesn't even exist. Or like the red herring is another way of saying it here. And that is when someone's doing this constant hypothesis testing. And hypothesis testing is okay in some scenarios. Maybe you've already made, you know, big headways in an area, but in which most cases, it doesn't do a great job of setting up an experiment. And so if you think of science in these three things, observe, measure, predict, it's easy to take away from, you know, whatever kind of information is present of, is there anything of value within this, you know, scientific inquiry? Or is there any science at all? Is it just story? Is it just opinion? You know?
Yeah.
And in terms of, I guess the second part of the question was, one was science and two was, help me remember.
Yeah. So it's implications of their health and well-being.
Yeah. So how to use it for your health and well-being. You know, the best way to start doing it is to have measurements for yourself. This is where I advocate for the N of one type of approach, to understand that the most important person for you to be able to compare to is yourself. You are the most important person. There's never going to be another you on the planet. And so having something as simple as your resting heart rate, that's a phenomenal measurement. Knowing your maximum box breathing of where you can get to, that's a phenomenal measure for how well you are doing day to day. And if one day you wake up and you can barely hold 8 seconds where previously you could do 16, you know that, you know, you should take a day of rest, or you should try and, you know, do your best to be able to, you know, take a day off. You need to make sure that you then you're okay. Otherwise, something bad's going to happen. And so that is the best way to go about it, is use your lived experience. You know, your feelings are very valid. Learn to communicate them and find find people to trust, find people to listen to, find people that are not trying to sell you a product. You know, people that are selling you knowledge, that's a different story. That's, I'm in the boat of selling knowledge. And obviously that's the approach I'm going to, you know, take. But once you learn it, you've learned it for life. And you then have it as, at your disposal. Whereas when you're having these products, you know, some, obviously some products are phenomenal and you can keep ordering them, but you know, why isn't it through the food? Why isn't it through, you know, different aspects of our lifestyle? And you know, that's, I guess the way about how to use science today in order to make yourself, you know, well, is anytime you get a test, anytime you kind of blood test, put that somewhere, you know, have a recording, have an idea of what your baselines are, so that within years time, you always have something to refer to as, you know, this is how I was in my 30s or 40s or 50s, and get interested in yourself, right? That's, that would be my, my best advice.
Wow. That's really, really great. So thank you so much, Daniel, for sharing your insights today. And it's really, really great. And also, at the same time, I'd love to mention this to all of our listeners that science literacy isn't about understanding the complex concepts, but it's about empowering ourselves to make informed decisions about our health and the well-being. So as we all learned, like by embracing the personalized approaches, like those offered by the timeline sciences, we can align our unique genetic makeup with our health goals, paving the way for a healthier and more fulfilling life. So we hope that this conversation has sparked your curiosity and inspired all of you to explore the fascinating world of science and its profound impact on our lives. So stay tuned for more thought-provoking discussions on Healthy Mind and Healthy Life. And until next time, take care and continue your journey towards optimal well-being. So thank you so much.